This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us for hour number two of the show. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Before we get going here, I want to pass on a little information that is related to the weather. There is a snow advisory in effect for much of northern and central Illinois on Tuesday, today, and for all of central Indiana today and tonight. Here in Champaign-Urbana, we are forecasting maybe as much as 4 inches of snow by this evening, and we already do have some weather-related early dismissals that we'd like to pass on to you. St. Joe Grade School and Middle School will be dismissing at 1 o'clock today. St. Joseph Ogden High School will dismiss at 1:10. Prairie View Ogden Grade School will dismiss at 1:20, and all after-school activities are canceled. Also, the Lake Shelbyville Muskie Club meeting scheduled for tonight at Eagle Creek Resort has been canceled. It's been rescheduled for March 6th. That's all the information, the weather-related closings we have for you right now. If we do have more, and I expect we probably will have more, we will pass them on to you as soon as we have that information available. And, of course, our next close look at the weather will be 12:35 this afternoon. As part of the afternoon magazine. At that point, we'll get the forecast. Mike Sola, I think, will be doing that, and he'll have some information on what's happening with the snow and perhaps a better idea about how much accumulation we can expect here in east central Illinois. So that's coming up later today on the afternoon magazine. Show itself gets underway at noon right after this one. Just last week, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Johanns, unveiled the USDA's 2007 Farm Bill proposal. So the current bill expires at the end of September, and writing new legislation, I'm sure a lot of people think, will be one of the most important items on the congressional agenda this year. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about the Farm Bill with Brad Redlin. He's Director of Agricultural Programs at the Isaac Walton League of America. I'm sure that he'll have a few things to say about the administration's ideas and also talk a bit about his organization's assessment of current farm policy and some of the recommendations that they have made. And indeed, they have put out a report, the 2007 Farm Bill, Stewardship, Prosperity, and Fairness, which addresses a number of issues, environmental issues, as well as their concerns about the welfare of family farms. And you can go to their website, I'm sure, and read that report. Questions here are welcome, too, here in this part of Focus 580, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. A little bit more about our guest. Brad Redlin was raised on his family's farm near Sidney, Montana. He began his career as a high school English teacher in Montana and also in South Dakota. After 6 years as editor of a biweekly news magazine in South Dakota, he turned his career toward his true passion, which was rural economic development. He became a federal analyst for the Center for Rural Affairs, then Lyons, Nebraska, and then after that served as media director, and then in 2004 accepted the national staff position of director of ag programs with the Isaac Walton League of America. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments, certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Redlin, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
I'm sure that over the months ahead, as the Farm Bill works its way through the process on our various programs, there will be a lot of discussion about this. We, on our station have for a long, long time been following agriculture and reporting a lot of agricultural news in one way or another. So there will be some people who are listening who are very following this very closely because it touches on their livelihood. At the same time, I'm sure that there are people who are listening who don't know anything about farm policy. And when we talk about it, find it completely confusing. Sometimes, when we talk about support payments and all that, and I would include myself, a lot of people who, it's like they say, it's like you're speaking some other language. They just don't get it. And I guess, one way to start would be to talk a little bit about why it is that anybody who is not involved in farming, involved in agriculture in any way, why really should they care about the Farm Bill?
And that's a great place to start, and it's the crux of the issue. And first of all, of course, is that we all eat, so that's going to certainly bring the Farm Bill into our purview. But it's also just about where we live as well as, what we eat. And one of the things that I like to point out when I'm talking with folks and addressing groups is that When you take the United States of America, 52% of all the land in the U.S. is in agricultural use, either as cropland or as pasture land. And in a state like Illinois, it's really almost three-fourths or at least two-thirds of the land is in strict agricultural use. So when it comes to congressional action, congressional legislation, there's really no other single piece of legislation that has a greater impact on the land that all of the land in the United States than the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is, of course, a huge omnibus bill made up of several titles that address everything from agricultural research to nutrition programs like school lunches and food stamps, that sort of thing, and then of course the price supports for commodity production, for grain production, and conservation programs, as you had mentioned before.
Do you? I think that, you know, obviously within agriculture, there's big business, there's middle-sized business, there's small business, and then the concerns of people, depending on what level they're at, are going to be very different. I think now for decades there has been a lot of concern voiced about smaller family farms, and the fact that the government policy ought to be doing what it can to try to help keep those people in business and actually even make it possible for somebody to, you know, for kids to continue to farm, and maybe even for somebody, if they decide that's what they want to do, to actually start in as a new farmer. It's extremely difficult. It may even be almost impossible. And it seems that now maybe some of the things that are being discussed for the new bill, maybe the idea is that more than we have in the past, we're trying to put some policies in place that are going to support smaller farms. Do you think that that's true?
I think there's real opportunities, no doubt. And I think that on behalf of the League and our report that you mentioned earlier, we spent a great deal of time examining the Farm Bill in the context of actual rural economies. I mean, that is what the Farm Bill is about. And as we are a conservation organization, but we understand that when you're going to engage on a Farm Bill, and again, we all are essentially constituents of the Farm Bill, regardless of whether we're production agriculture operators or not. But nonetheless, if you're going to engage in the Farm Bill, you really need to be responsible about it and understand why it exists, what its purposes are for, and certainly farmers and farming are the focal point of it. So we spent a lot of time looking at just that, the rural economy and the opportunities that exist for farming and how the Farm Bill affects it. Then we found that, as you kind of alluded to, there's been a lot of discussion over the years about, save the family farm and support the family farm. And we certainly, essentially echo those sentiments, but it's much more complicated than simple cliches, really. And part of the problem is that historically, policy that was, originally developed in the 1930s to guarantee opportunity for farmers and support them in difficult times has evolved to have some negative aspects to it. The concept of a safety net still exists in farm programs, that being essentially as it's constructed now, a vehicle whereby which if prices are very low for crops, for commodities, the government comes in to help. Prices go into a higher, strong market price cycle, then the government provides less help. There's less intervention on behalf of the government. But as we found in our report and report in the research that's been done, there's also, real negative aspects and frankly problems with the existing safety net in the sense that where it does provide the support for low prices, it doesn't provide, along with that, a maximum amount of support that can be divvied out. And what that creates then is, without the limits on the top side of it, it drives production. It when there's no limit upon which the government will stop funding a farm operation, the incentive then is to continue to produce. And that can create incentives for overproduction even in times of low prices. So it becomes a self-defeating safety net in the sense of it is oversupplying even in times of oversupply. So that's something that certainly can be corrected. Now there's a lot of discussion to be had about the fact that we're experiencing a real high market price environment for many, if not most, of all the commodity crops, the grain crops. So that creates real opportunities there as well.
I'm just interested in your reaction to, so far, what the administration has laid out there in terms of proposal for the new bill, what will be the new bill for the 2007 bill. Obviously, one thing that actually seems to be going on is they're interested in shrinking the spending on farm programs, and they're proposing a cut. One of the things that they're talking about, maybe to address the, in part would address your concern, is they're talking about making cuts on the top end, and the kind of payments that go to farmers on the very top. They also are interested in energy, and they're also seem to be interested in conservation, all the things that are very important to you and your organization as well. What do you think about what so far now the administration has said about what they'd like the new farm bill to look like?
Well, it's a mixed bag, as you may have been able to predict me to say, but I think you characterized it pretty accurately. They are coming in with some proposals for limiting spending. They're utilizing this opportunity of the high market prices that are really driven by ethanol, and you know, which is essentially as well driven by the $70 per barrel of oil that we saw last year. That really made this ethanol boom occur, which has certainly driven up the price for corn, and subsequently driven up the prices for soybean and even wheat as the ground becomes an area of competition for planting the crops. I'm reading some market analysis that talking about 12 to even 20% of the cotton acres being turned to corn, so that those kinds of supply changes create incentives for higher prices. So the USDA's proposal assumes that there's going to be higher market prices. And when there's that safety net system that is based upon paying when prices are low and not when the when prices are high, when those target prices essentially that exist in farm policy are surpassed by the market, then no payments are made. USDA's proposal assumes that those prices will be high and those payments will not be made, so that there is just automatic savings essentially gained right there, and that provides an opportunity for them to look elsewhere for utilizing money. It creates a different issue as you said at the outset, it's also very complex, but it creates a different issue where the budget that is utilized by Congress to work with as they write out farm bills are generally 5 years, give or take, 5-year time periods. And the Congressional Budget Office actually determines a budget forecast, says what the budget is going to be going forward, and that essentially becomes the number that technically the Congressional Budget Committees and then the Congressional Agriculture Committees use to determine how much spending there will be in the farm bill. The issue that is created by this high price, low support payment environment is that the forecast then is that there will be less money needed for the farm bill. While that provides certain savings, it also limits the pool for all of the farm bill programs. For instance, one of the things we look at in my organization is the opportunities that have not been fully realized for providing real assistance, not just ecological, but economic assistance to rural America through conservation programs, through developing the natural amenities that communities have. Through the conservation programs that assist water quality and soil quality and wildlife habitat and that sort of thing. While it's a blessing in one sense that money can be saved in the price support side of the farm bill, given the Congressional Budget Office forecasting techniques that may not actually realize savings to actually be utilized in other portions of the farm bill.
Let me just ask you real quick, this is in a sense getting going off on a different road, but
sure.
Because now there has been, as a matter of policy, the administration has said we're interested in increasing production of renewable fuels and that they see ethanol produced from some variety of sources, possibly from corn, possibly from some kind of grass, you know, so you have your different forms. Does it concern you that drive to produce ethanol and its effect on prices is going to lead to putting a lot of additional land into production to grow some kind of crop, and that in fact what's going to happen is we're going to have marginal land that probably shouldn't be put into production simply because the high prices, it's just too tempting not to.
Well, that's a very real risk, and it's a fascinating time right now to see to be here at this kind of the precipice of a kind of a brave new world here with fuel being a real component of the farm bill, and it's really dramatically affected the landscape as far as just the policy activity in Congress and amongst advocacy groups and farm groups, what have you, throughout the nation, that where people were talking about global trade being a big impact on the farm bill a year ago, now it's just the dramatic impact that that you know ethanol in general is having. And yes, we are concerned that it's wonderful that you know a decades long process on the part of farm families to create this new marketplace for them for ethanol, if it has succeeded. I mean, they are receiving a good price from the marketplace for their crop, and that was, you know, the goal all along. It's nice to see that success. We're not certainly have any negative things to say about that, but it does concern us that the pressure will certainly be there to people to take possibly land out of, you know, a conservation set-aside contract, for instance, and seed it. That's certainly their right. We don't want to stand in anyone's way of doing that. We're concerned, though, if the land itself is really pretty marginal or even particularly highly erodible, that it doesn't really serve them either in the sense of getting really a good production off of that. So the risk is that some lands that shouldn't be farmed may be finding themselves tempted to be farmed now. As we approach that, we think that existing programs, the primary one in that category being the Conservation Reserve Program, which has allows up to 39 million acres nationwide to be enrolled, has really only ever actually had about 36 million acres enrolled. A lot of people are looking at those acres and thinking, well, that's a good place to get more corn planted. And frankly, the reason they want a lot more corn planted is to bring the price back down, which doesn't necessarily serve all farmers, but it in turn provides some concern to us in the sense that that is land that was enrolled, or certainly is, as the ranking system currently exists, it is to be enrolled because it is the most erodible or has the greatest potential for being wildlife habitat, that sort of thing. We don't want to see really any rewriting of rules or really any intervention into the existing programs based on the current market prices. We think that the Conservation Reserve Program specifically has been around since 85 Farm Bill. It has a proven track record. If it's under pressure right now due to high prices, let the program stand and fight on its merits. In other words, we don't want to see Congress or the administration through USDA do any changes to the Farm Bill to incent people to get their land CRP. We don't want to see people are proposing backdoors to cancel contracts, that sort of thing. There's a lot of contracts that are coming up for renewal at this time period anyway. If people do want out, they have the ability to get out. We'll just let it fight it out on its own merits in that context.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Brad Redlin. He's Director of Agricultural Programs with the Isaac Walton League of America, an environmental organization that's been around since the 1920s. They're certainly interested in conservation issues, but they're also interested in rural areas, their health, their economy, and sustainability in agriculture, the health of family farms, all among the various things that they're interested in. They have put out a report with some of their thoughts and recommendations when it comes to writing the new farm bill, the one for 2007 that Congress will be working on this year. The administration also has put out its proposals for the farm bill, and it's the kind of thing that will be discussed a great deal here in the months ahead. Questions and comments are certainly welcome here on the program, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a couple callers here ready to talk with us. We'll start with someone on the cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My family prefers to buy food that's been locally grown, and we happen to live in an area that is surrounded by corn and soybean fields. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what there is in the farm bill and just how the government supports the growing of corn and soybeans rather than, you know, food that people eat. So we have food that animals are eating growing all around us or that's being shipped elsewhere, but it's not that easy to find food in our supermarket that's been locally grown, and I will hang up and get back on the road and listen offline.
Well, thanks for the call then.
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating aspect of farm production in America, is that in the Midwest or in other places certainly as well, it's not really food that we can really access. And the Farm Bill is set up just, again, historically, going back to the 1930s, it has selected specific commodity production crops, and 90% of all the support payments that go for crop production go to just five crops, and that's corn, cotton, wheat, rice, and soybeans, with corn being the largest, cotton next. And the reality then, and that's something that we address in our report again, is that that creates certainly an incentive for production. If you're contemplating growing a crop, and you know that the government provides a price support system that if prices fall, if you grow corn, then the incentive naturally would be to grow corn rather than to experiment with some form of beans or what have you, or flax. I guess some of these are supported as well, but it tends to drive a particular model of production, and that's what the caller commented on, that she sees corn and soybeans around her. Another really more complex thing that's a little difficult to address, we'll try to do it real briefly, is that the arena of agriculture production that's called specialty crops, and that is the things like the lettuce or apples or wine grapes or what have you, more commonly food type systems, vegetables, fruit and vegetables, they aren't actually supported like the corn crops are. There's not price targets for them. There's not government intervention in the marketplace as far as paying prices for those productions. But there is a rule to their benefit, if you can follow along with this, which states that land that has been used for corn and soybean production, any of those major, for instance, five commodity crops, that as long as they do not grow corn and, or excuse me, as long as they don't grow the fruits or vegetables, they're eligible for payments through the Farm Bill. If they do grow fruits and vegetables, they are not eligible. Now, the California, Florida, or whatever fruit and vegetable farmers like that because it provides a disincentive for anyone in the Midwest to compete with them in the growing of fruits and vegetables, if you're following me here. So it is another disincentive for people around the caller's home there to grow the food that people would actually eat. So the Farm Bill does have a couple of instances there that do kind of create really unnecessary obstacles to local food production. And the USDA's proposal, as you'd mentioned earlier, actually addresses that in one way, and they propose eliminating that rule, which does not allow the growing of fruit and vegetables in Midwest commodity production acres. It does provide, the USDA's proposal does provide really emphasis on research and delivering dollars for the expanding production of fruits and vegetables. So the that side of the agricultural industry was trying to be served through those processes. But then, again, it's just an issue of trying to take really some unintended consequences of prioritizing these specific crops with specific price supports that create a landscape that is not necessarily what would be occurring otherwise, in the sense of your caller saying she's surrounded by corn and soybean fields. If government policy was written different, it would probably look different around her home.
We're at our midpoint here, and we have another caller I want to get to in a moment. First, though, let me just return to the weather for a moment, too, for people who are listening this morning, because we've had some more weather-related closings starting to come in. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, there is a snow advisory in effect for much of northern and central Illinois today and for all of central Indiana for today and tonight. And in fact, all of the counties in our severe weather coverage area are included in this snow advisory here in Champaign-Urbana. We're expecting the possibility of up to 4 inches by tonight. And I just want to, again, run down the list of weather-related closings for you. All Mahomet Seymour schools will dismiss at 1 today, and all after-school and evening activities have been canceled. All Monticello schools will dismiss 2 hours early. Also in Monticello, White Heath Small Wonders afternoon program is canceled. The Gifford Grade School will be dismissing at 12:45. St. Joe Grade School and Middle School dismiss at 1. St. Joe Ogden High School dismisses at 1:10. Prairie View Ogden Grade School will dismiss at 1:20. All after-school activities are canceled. The St. Joe Township Library will be closing at 6 p.m. today, and all Unit 7 Tolono schools will dismiss at 12:30 today, and all athletic events are canceled for tonight. That's what we have right for the moment, and again, we'll have an update for you on the weather from, I think, from Mike Sola. He's in the weather office, was this morning. That'll be as part of the afternoon magazine at 12:35. And, of course, if we get more weather-related information or closings, we will pass them on to you. Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Brad Redlin. He's director of agricultural programs with the Isaac Walton League of America. He grew up on a farm in Montana. And with his brothers and sisters, they continue to maintain the family farm in Montana. Approximately 2,000 acres of dry land, wheat, and grassland, including Conservation Reserve Program contracts. He's worked with some number of different organizations since 2004. He's been with the Isaac Walton League. He's also chaired the Midwest Sustainable Agriculture Working Group's Conservation and Environment Committee. He was participant in the Minnesota State Technical Committee of USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Service and other kinds of organizations that have to do with conservation sustainability, which, of course, are concerns of the folks at the Isaac Walton League. And they have put out a report with their kinds of thoughts and recommendations about farm policy for 2007. And I'm sure if you go to their website, you can read their report. Questions here on the show are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And let's talk with somebody in Charleston, not all that far away from here. Line four, hello.
Yes, three questions. Does your guest think these are ethanol related?
Sure.
That, first of all, that it'll provide only 20% of the needs. And is that sustainable, just to supply 20%?
Yeah, you want to go one at a time with these?
We'll do that.
Yeah, I'm happy to, sure.
Sure.
No, I think that's a very real concern. I think that certainly from our organization's platform is that conserving fuel use is going to be an absolute necessity. I mean, the scenarios are drawn out that... we saw in the State of the Union address where they're targeting 35 billion gallons by the year 2017, or maybe as many as 60 billion by 2030, of renewable fuels, essentially ethanols or biodiesels or what have you. Unfortunately, under current trend lines for expanded use of fuels in the United States, that if we were to reach those targets, they would actually be impacting the increased use, not what is already currently being used. So there's real concern that we're very clear and we're all approaching this biofuels question with our eyes wide open and understand that it's not a replacement for petroleum fuels that cannot reach that level. It is, nonetheless, we've determined a worthwhile effort done properly. I mean, it does reduce the polluting factors of fossil fuels to a degree. It can provide real opportunities in the sense of this grand new opportunity or new goal that everyone has when they talk about the cellulosic production of ethanol. That's being done through woody biomass or prairie grasses in particular, that there's real, you know, opportunity to be achieved there in the sense of water quality, of soil retention, of wildlife habitat, of even carbon sequestration, if this this great new opportunity comes to fruition, where, you know, we could transition some fields that are currently in row crops, corn, soybeans, or wheat, or what have you, into perennial mixed native grasses year round that you know serve to to filter water runoff. They serve to hold the soil in place. Like I said, serve to provide wildlife habitat, all those things that that could be a real opportunity if it is a viable marketplace for using grasses for production of ethanol. So there is opportunity in ethanol, and I think if we go at it with conservation standards and economic ownership that is local and that sort of thing, there's opportunity there. But I think your caller is right. We have to certainly be very realistic about this and know that it's not the vehicle for energy independence, because we could never really produce enough.
Yes. Okay. So then, in as 20%, that would probably maximize the amount of difference between fossil fuels and ethanol. So we cannot get 50% or 60% and such as that in ethanol-related products in order to run our cars. Okay, second question is, if what I understand is correct, that it takes, there's two guesses, 3 gallons to 6 gallons of water to produce 3 quarts of ethanol combined with 1 gallon of gasoline to fuel up the cars and trucks and, you know, all the other, the internal combustion engine with all of its problems. How close is that call?
That's essentially my understanding as well. The standard line, I guess, that I hear and we use in our egg program and our energy program here in the league is that generally the most common ethanol production plants right now, it is about a 4-gallon to 1-gallon ratio of water to ethanol. So in other words, it takes 4 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of ethanol. And that obviously causes serious concern, and we address that as well in discussing this issue. It's one more thing you definitely need to have your eyes wide open on. We have to approach this very responsibly, that the idea being that if we're going to go into ethanol production and you start looking at, we've got great, I was talking about the cellulosic ethanol production, for instance, and you think, well, we've got these great grasslands in western Kansas or western Nebraska or northeastern Montana where my home farm is. Well, those are also very dry areas in western Nebraska, western Kansas. We have an Ogallala aquifer that's being depleted right now. So if we think, well, if we're going to fill that up with ethanol plants, that's certainly not a responsible activity either. On the optimistic side, there's folks out there saying, well, we can go to new technologies. There's reports of a ethanol plant right now in existence that I think it's in Texas that they claim they're about to a 1-to-1 ratio. In other words, 1 gallon of water for 1 gallon of ethanol. More positive is technologies that would be would really move away from the water use at all and explore things that I'm certainly not an expert on, but gasification processes for cellulose that turns it into fuel that way without using the enzymatic production. In other words, the soaking of the feedstock that's currently used, whether it's corn or the very few in existence so far cellulosic ethanol plants where they just soak the product in water with the enzymes.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a Bushian ideal, you know, that's achievable. But now the last thing I'll bring, I said three, and I'm sorry, David, if I'm holding on. But the thing is, where now it becomes a moral question. How is it possible in a population of 6 billion people upon this earth, and we're taking food, human food, I mean, even if it is, my brother-in-law's a farmer, and he says there's edible corn, human corn, and animal corn. Well, if we can produce human corn, why can't we produce enough human corn that we can help sustain the diets and the life within people around this globe? And that's what I find the most reprehensible about all this, is taking human food and converting it into something that can be run through the internal combustion engine that will continue to pollute. It'll be less, but it burns and it creates the heat and all the other things that are wrong with the way we are socially organized just now. And then to take food out of the mouths of, even if we just set the adults aside and the children who are starving to death in this world, and we think about putting food in the gas tank, I find that to be the most reprehensible of all these ideas. And that's my last question. Why can't we be more humane? I'll ring off, David. Thanks.
Well, all right. You comment on that any way you like.
Okay, well, I sure will. But, I mean, it's a real valid concern. There's no question about it, by all means. And I think that in a couple instances, number one, it's like that. I mean, speaking for myself personally as well as my organization, I mean, that is why we see another drive towards if we can achieve this cellulosic ethanol, this production of biofuels from, you know, mixed prairie grasses, native prairie grasses, things that are natural to the landscape and are not food otherwise for people or animals for that matter. That is one way to address that. It's certainly also true that while the ethanol is using up a lot of corn, and it's going to be using up more and more in the next several years, it's an unfortunate reality of existing economics, existing trade realities, what have you, where the corn, again, as the caller alluded to, isn't necessarily at all food that is being utilized in these ethanol plants, and the corn that even is and has previously gone to export has unfortunately not gone to countries that would necessarily most need it. The research shows that in tracking exports, you know, over the decades, frankly, that it is wealthy countries for the most part that receive the export of grain that we do provide, and it's the hungry populations are not receiving either the grain themselves or certainly the animals that are fed on it. So it's, in a sense, a little bit of a misnomer to think that the ethanol plants are taking food from anyone's mouth. That's particularly anyone who is starving or deeply in need of food. It's just not the case. It wasn't going to get to them regardless. It's an unfortunate reality. I'm not endorsing that reality, but it is the reality.
Well, just for a second, I think we made the point that that ethanol can be produced from a variety of feed stocks. It can be made from corn. It can be made from sugar beets. It can also be made from cellulosic sources like prairie grass. And I think that's there's research on that going on right here on this campus and in other places too. And I know that some people think that in fact that kind of plant source for ethanol makes sense and maybe makes more sense than using corn. Do you, and how much, I don't know if you know this, what kind of money is going into that kind of research, and would you like to see, I imagine you would say yes, you would like to see more money put into looking at developing that source of ethanol as maybe alongside of starch-based ethanols?
We do, yeah. And we think that the corn-based ethanol, the sugar-based ethanol, like you say, is should be a transition vehicle. If ethanol is going to be fully realized, if you know that this potential that we're standing looking at, looking over right now, that is to be realized to achieve things like the 35 billion gallons by 2017 or the 60 billion gallons by 2030, that there's no other way but to utilize other biomass sources. And certainly we would like to see those other biomass sources being, as I said, mixed natural native grasses and that sort of thing, rather than essentially just commodifying grass for ethanol production and creating some of the same problems that we identify in current intensive industrial agriculture production forms. That too holds risks, the sense of even our ideal, the multiple native species grasses grown for ethanol production, we have to be very responsible about that too. I mean, if we are essentially growing grass but denuding the land with harvesting it, it's not really achieving the carbon sequestration goals that it could possibly achieve if it's not done at the proper time of year, that sort of thing. It certainly could impact very negatively habitat for wildlife if
harvest is occurring at inopportune times. Other factors that really are going to require us to proceed very responsibly on this. And we're actually at an exciting time in the sense that this is all laying out before us yet. We are at that moment where we can make these decisions that haven't been made yet on this form of agriculture production. We are at the time which those decisions are being made, so it's incumbent on us to make sure that we approach it responsibly, and that's what we advocate for. We said there should be research done now in this farm bill's life cycle. It's probably going to be about 5 years. We're not to a point yet where we're producing a lot of ethanol from grasses or from woody biomass, so it's a time to practice and to research rather than go into full modes production. So let's take this time to do that very thing, practice how it's produced, if we can produce it most beneficially, conservation, economically, and ecologically. But at the same time, develop then, through that research, some standards that can be adhered to going forward for making sure that we do provide for the most carbon sequestration, we provide for the most beneficial wildlife habitat, and set those standards in place so that really we'd love to see the idea of, like, certainly in the forestry industry right now, you have sustainably certified wood products. Well, we'd love to see sustainably certified biomass production.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Brad Redlin. He's director of agricultural programs at the Isaac Walton League of America. It's one of the country's oldest conservation organizations, and among other things, they're interested in strengthening farmers and rural communities and preserving natural resources at the same time. And they have a few things to say about farm policy and have weighed in on the writing of the farm bill. And if you're interested in some of their thoughts of the organization, you can look at this report I've mentioned on the 2007 farm bill. You can go to their website, which is www.iwla.org, and you can find out more about it and look at that report. We have some calls here. We'll try to get them in the time that remains and talk with someone next in Mattoon, and that's line one.
Good
Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. I understand that sugar cane is used, I believe, in South America, and it's very efficient for producing ethanol, and apparently we have tariffs to prevent any of that from coming up here. Is it possible for us to find sugar cane someplace or grow it in the South? Or would you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I'll preface it with the fact that I'm not an expert on sugar cane in particular, or even entirely on ethanol for that matter by any means. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That is the primary feedstock for ethanol in Brazil, which is often held up as the country which is most adopted ethanol as a main fuel source. And it bears noting that when people do present Brazil as this shining example of ethanol production and utilization, that we essentially produce and will be producing more ethanol already in this country than Brazil does on the whole. So it's just the fact that they're also a smaller country and the fact that they have so much of this, 85% ethanol and that sort of thing. It's not necessarily fair to say, well, we're so far behind them. Well, actually, we're actually out-producing them already, but we are just so much bigger and use so much more that sugarcane is an option for us. But that since, oftentimes, and I'm not saying your caller believes this, but oftentimes people say, well, if we use sugarcane like Brazil, then we would be, running every car on 85% ethanol, and we'd replace 85% of our fuel use for vehicles. Well, that's not going to happen here either. It's just not the land. We don't have enough acres to produce that much.
We can't produce sugar cane in the South?
No, we can, but we just can't produce enough to, by any means, equal Brazil's model for how much of their fuel they've replaced with ethanol, because we use just so much more. We just don't have the acreage that can grow that much sugar cane.
Isn't it true, though, that we do have a tariff on...
Yes, that was a good point, and that's something that... the administration has proposed removing as part of that. I'd mentioned it before, we're in the State of the Union, where the president said that we want to reach 35 billion gallons by 2017. Just for reference, we're about at 5 billion gallons right now. I'd expect we'll be at 7 billion gallons, 7.5, 8 by next year. So we're talking about really five times the amount of ethanol we're currently producing by 2017. When the president proposed that in the fine print, frankly, was his proposal also to remove that tariff so that we would import a lot of ethanol from other countries in order to reach that that goal of the 35 billion gallons. A lot of people are going to argue that that's absolutely necessity in order to ever reach it, and a lot of people are going to be very unsupportive of that, that are in ethanol production in the United States who don't want that other ethanol brought in.
But if we did have a source of sugar cane, though, it would be much more efficient to produce it using sugar cane than corn and so on?
Yeah, the sugar cane is probably because it's the current enzymatic ethanol production is sugar-based, and that's what they use corn for. It is sugar production, and so sugar cane is that much more efficient because it's that much closer to the sugar, you know, in the process of extracting it. So it is more efficient. It does continue the same concerns, though, certainly about, for instance, water use. It's still enzymatic ethanol production, so you're still using lots of gallons of water for each gallon of ethanol you produce and that sort of thing. So it is a more efficient ethanol source than corn right now, but it's not by any means the answer.
Well, I thought it might help, but
yeah, it could.
Not have to use so much corn.
Yeah, it could.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. And I just want to mention here that we've been talking here, our producers, we've been talking about trying to get some more programs here into the schedule sometime soon, hopefully over the next couple of weeks, to talk some more about ethanol, because obviously people have a lot of questions about it. So we can get some people on here who can talk both about potential benefits and some of the questions that have been raised about the amount of water that it takes to produce it, and environmental impact, and impact on the food supply, and all those sorts of things. So we're working on seeing if we can get some more conversation about that going here, so people can have the opportunity to ask questions. We're coming down here to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left, and we've talked about a number of things. We've talked about energy. We've talked a little bit about conservation issues. We've talked a little bit about farm payments. I guess I just want to make sure that if there's some other areas that you'd like to talk about, we can spend at least a couple of minutes doing that, because we've kind of jumped around and talked a little bit about a lot of things.
Well, that's all right, and I like it. And I think I may have run on a little too long on most of these questions, but there's one thing I did want to point out, and I mentioned it real briefly earlier, but this idea of providing, you know, real economic support to the Farm Bill, and that is its purpose, mm-hmm. and that is something that a purpose that, speaking for myself and the organization, we certainly support, and we want to see that delivered in the best way possible. We support the idea of there being a safety net in the Farm Bill and the commodity title and the production payment support system. We don't even advocate for removing that. But we do want to really alert people, if nothing else, just put it in terms of alerting to the fact that there's real opportunity for economic growth through conservation. And the Farm Bill contains a whole suite of programs on, like I said, those supply-based systems for price supporting on production, but that also contains a whole suite of programs on conservation that some involved, idling lands or turning it to grass. Like I said, there's, for instance, the Conservation Reserve Program. Other programs, like one that was new with the last Farm Bill that has great potential, is a Conservation Security Program, where it bases its prices on active land that's in agricultural production rather than retiring it, and it scores essentially the producer in terms of financial incentives on how well they maintain their production systems with conservation in mind. In other words, what practices do they use to maintain good soil quality, water quality, what have you, in the active production of their agricultural land. The more they provide in terms of conservation practices, the higher the payment they get. So there is a model right there that sees approaching farm supports a little differently. Rather than paying for production, you pay them for protection. And that's a public benefit, and that seems logical for public investment to be utilized that way. But further than that, even, there's this aspect, and it's frankly kind of a school of research at USDA right now that's about natural amenities. And this is just as simple as opportunities for outdoor recreation. That can mean hiking, kayaking, or fishing and hunting, that sort of thing. or just pleasant landscapes, you know, functioning wetlands. These are natural amenities that communities have, and conservation programs through the Farm Bill are utilized to enhance those things, whether it's idling the land, putting in grass for habitat, or it's something like a wetlands reserve program that protects shallow wetlands, what have you, for which are very good for obviously wildlife production, but they're also great for sequestering carbon, that sort of thing, and also provide natural amenities to a community. And USDA research shows that it is those communities, in fact, they break it out by counties, and they find that the counties that have protected and enhanced their natural amenities, broadly defined, see not only job and population retention, but job and population growth. And beyond even that, growth in the number of farms, which is actually a fairly dramatic statistic if you know the circumstances of the agriculture industry right now, where it's really a consolidating industry, where it's consistently becoming fewer and fewer farms and larger farms. But they find that, for instance, the Federal Reserve Bank's done their own research on this and determined that those counties, say the top 25% of counties that receive the production payments for growing corn or cotton, for instance, are the counties that statistically lose the most population, lose the most jobs. And juxtapose that with the fact that counties, rural counties that enhance their natural amenities, something that conservation farm bill programs can do, are the counties that are actually increasing their population, increasing jobs, and increasing numbers of farms. So we want to make sure that as we look at the health of rural America across the spectrum, ecological as well as economical, that conservation programs have a very key role to play in that.
We're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest for this part of the show, Brad Redlin. He's director of ag programs at the Isaac Walton League of America. And if you're interested in reading more about the league, its activities, its ideas about farm policy, you go to their website, www.iwla.org. And Mr. Redlin, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.